All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
Hey there, welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, a CW2 helicopter pilot type person from, many, many years ago, 1968-69. Want to welcome you to our program today. I've got, I think, some really great guests. Number one is Hope Hodge-Seck, and she's going to be talking about the prepping for the next fight. And we're going to be talking about some of the major changes that the various services are going through, and as they, you know, as they move into the future and look at different weaponry and, you know, recruiting and so on and so forth. So I think that's going to be really interesting. And in the second half of the program, we're going to be talking about universal service and national service, that is. And I think you'll find that really interesting. It was an idea. Well, I mean, it's been an idea proposed forever. And as a result of the volunteer army, we know that the numbers have gone down as far as recruiting is concerned. And so this idea was first proposed by Colonel Jack Jacobs, a Medal of Honor recipient, Vietnam veteran, back in 2013. And we're trying to see if we can get some traction behind this. So we're going to be talking about universal national service in the second half of the program. And if you'd like to get in on the conversation on either end of the program, you can give us a call live at 734-822-1600. 734-822-1600. But before I get to my first guest, we have to thank our sponsors, because we can't do this whole thing without sponsors. And so we're going to start off with our longest serving sponsor, and that is Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans specializes in veterans' disability claims. For more information, you can go to their website, legalhelpforveterans.com, or give them a call at 800-693-4800. The National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, is the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of veteran-owned businesses. For more information, you can go to their website, that's nvbdc.org, or give them a call at 888-237-8433. That's 888-237-8433. If you are a small veteran-owned business and you want to do work, get contracts with the federal government, you need to be certified as a real live veteran-owned business. And these are the folks that will do that for you. So check them out. That's nvbdc.org. The Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center here in Ann Arbor, Michigan. For more information about the Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center, just go to va.gov/Ann Arbor Healthcare. And of course, we'd also like to thank our longtime sponsors, the Irwin Prescott American Legion Post number 46 and the Charles S. Kettles Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 310, both of Ann Arbor, Michigan. If you would like to become a sponsor, all you got to do is go to veteransradio.org and click on the sponsorship button. We're more looking for more and more sponsors if we can. We can't do this for free. So we're trying to, you know, gather the funds to pay for the various affiliates that we are on and equipment and so forth. If you would like to donate to Veterans Radio, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit corporation, again, you can go to the website, veteransradio.org, and click on the donate button. Now, we're kind of a little thing we're trying to do this year, since this is our 20th year, is $20 for 20 years. That's a pretty good deal, I think. So, go and click on that button, and we would greatly appreciate your support. All right, let's get right into our program right now. My guest is Hope Hodge-Seck, and she is a writer on military issues. She's based out of Washington. Now, for those that have watched Veteran Radio or listened to Veterans Radio over the year, Hope was on before when she was the managing editor for military.com. Her previous assignments have included a war zone embedded in Afghanistan with the Marines, multiple reporting trips aboard amphibious ships and aircraft carriers. Her awards include multiple North Carolina Press Association honors, the 2015 and 2017 Marine Corps Heritage Foundation Heinle Awards. Just a great writer, and this is an expert, a real expert on what's going on in the military today. So, Hope, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you know, when I got my magazine, the magazine that I'm talking about right now is from the Military Officers Association of America. It's their magazine, and on the very cover, I'm sorry we're not doing this with video, but we should. It says, "Prepping for the next fight. Find out what's in store this year for our uniformed services." And we're going to talk about all the services a little bit today. I hope you don't mind. And how did you come about writing this article?
So I love working with Military Officer Magazine. I write for a lot of different outlets, but they are one of my favorite clients because they are very forward-looking when it comes to how best to serve the military and veterans community. And in fact, they have, I was just looking it up now, I think 360,000 members in Military Officer Association of America. So this is a regular feature they do where they take a look forward at what matters most to the different military services, both for operational things, equipment, deployments, but also really practical things like pay and benefits and healthcare. So this is a regular feature, and I was really honored to do it for them.
Well, it's a really interesting article for one thing, and I, you know, with all the turmoil that was involved with that particular senator who didn't want to let the you know, the newest commanders of all the various branches of the service get through this committee, everybody seemed to hit it all at the same time in November, I think it was. And so let's start off with the Army. So I'm looking here as the Army really is mostly concerned, it looks like, with radical recruiting overall. Their numbers are so down.
That's right. And the Army, of course, that's the largest military service. So they tend to have, you know, the things that all the services are struggling, they have kind of the biggest proportion of. And this past end of the fiscal year, they missed their recruiting goal for a second time in a row on active duty accessions. And that's a big deal. Now, they are being really aggressive about how to get after this. And they've already rolled out some elements of what they're calling a recruiting transformation. They're looking at populations that they haven't reached as well as they could in urban environments, in places in the U.S. that they haven't had as much of a reach as they would like to. How to connect with the younger generation. The interests and concerns of Gen Z are different from millennials, and those are certainly different from Gen Xers. And this is a little peek into the future. I have it on good authority that the Army is about to roll out a whole new tranche of recruiting initiatives in the next month or so here. So I don't have a lot of details on that yet, but that's definitely something to keep an eye on.
Are you talking incentives?
You know, I would love to know the details of that because everyone wants to know where the bonuses are. Mm-hmm. I have heard, though, because, you know, I've been in these conversations with recruiting officials. And in fact, we're going to do a deep dive on recruiting for Military Officer Magazine in an upcoming issue, that the services are aware that they can't just keep pouring incentive money at this problem. Bonuses are not the long-term permanent solution. So I think you're going to see some more outside the box thinking.
Yeah, well, I would think so. And I know that in the article you were talking about that they're doing this test program. I think it was down to, was it Fort Jackson, South Carolina?
That's right, where they take these recruits who are not quite up to Army spec, and you'll hear all of the services and certainly the Army saying, we're not lowering standards. We're not going to change the bar. But taking recruits who might be able to make that bar but are not making it already, whether it's on height and weight, whether it's on academics, and saying, we'll coach you, we'll bring you up to standard. And so far, that's been a pretty successful effort on the part of the Army. So they're looking to build on and expand that.
I think that sounds, that's really interesting, that sort of like minor leagues for a sport. You know,
exactly.
Or you're going to some of these sport training schools that they have out there because you're not quite fast enough, or you're not quite tall enough, or you're not whatever it is, and then they build you up, and then you can take that next step, you know, into the program. I think that sounds like a cool idea.
Yeah, it's like an Army farm team. You've got to do the Rocky montage, getting ready for the fight.
Yeah, plus maybe I'm sure they must get paid while they do that.
Yes, that's my understanding. It's kind of like a pre-boot camp.
Yeah. Oh boy, I can hardly wait to do that again. I don't think so. So you also mentioned in the article about the Army, their new combat vehicle, this M10 Booker.
Yes. So this has been about a decade in development, and we're finally seeing some action on turning it into a reality. Now, Army combat vehicles in general, or any military service, these things don't move fast. And even the relatively rapid progress takes years. Something interesting to look at that goes beyond the scope of the story is the various services are looking at ways to integrate hybrid and electric technology. So I don't know if you'll see that directly for the Booker, but they're considering the options there and certainly looking ahead to future combat vehicles.
It sounds like a really kind of a cool vehicle. It's a kind of a mini tank. I'm reading from the article here. We're talking with Hope Hodge Sect, who wrote this article, and I thought it was so cool because the Booker is named after a Medal of Honor recipient, a private Robert D. Booker, who died in World War II, and a Distinguished Service Cross recipient, Staff Sergeant Stefan Booker, who unfortunately passed away from his injuries in Operation Iraqi Freedom. So I didn't get a chance to look it up and go, Jesus, these guys are related? I don't know if they are or not. I'll have to check it out. But it said that it looks like a smaller Abrams tank with its tracks and 105mm gun turret. I think that might stop a few people along the way. Substantial firepower in the fight. Yeah. So I think that's kind of cool. And so for those of you that are listening and want to find out more about it, just go, you know, type into Google M10 Booker. See what it, you know, what comes up with. It's kind of a cool picture of what it looks like. It's in the magazine. So moving on from the Army, let's go to the Marine Corps, which I thought was really interesting in that the Marine Corps is kind of transitioning away from their tanks and focusing more on, I don't know, it sounded like, what's the word I'm looking for? I just forgot it. Age-related problems come along every once in a while. More individual training and not, you know, not utilizing the, you know, the tank aspect of it.
That's right. Well, the Marine Corps is officially tank-free as a service. They've divested of all of their tanks, and they are looking to get lighter and leaner. And this has been a subject of some controversy on Capitol Hill. There are certainly folks, and particularly in the retired ranks, retired general officers, who say the Marine Corps is changing too much, too fast, getting rid of infantry components, various capabilities. But the Marine Corps is looking forward to that future fight, and they want to be able to send small units for island hopping operations in the Pacific, to be able to operate independently when they can't get quick resupply. They want to transport on Ospreys and vehicles that can fit inside Ospreys, and they're really looking at creative ways to sustain that kind of light, agile fighter. And the Marine Corps, as I'm sure you know, is very, very concerned about its own identity as a separate capability from the Army, as something that no other service offers, as kind of this hybrid amphibious force that it's always been. And this is the picture that they've come up with. And there, it's now a couple of commandants who have kind of sustained this vision, and it is moving forward into the future.
Well, you in the article, you talk about them and seemingly concentrating more on the South Pacific part of the world. And, you know, letting the Army take care of Army and the rest of them take care of the Middle East. But Is this something that is part of this overhaul of the Marines?
Absolutely. And the Marine Corps will tell you that some of the biggest potential future fights, future adversaries are right there in the Pacific. You think about China, which is a technological and geopolitical threat and increasingly very capable, investing in its military capacity. And then there are unstable actors out there like North Korea. So even though the Middle East continues to pop up as a center of conflict, as we've seen even recently, the Marine Corps is making a big bet that the future sort of the big near peer power struggle is going to be in the Pacific.
Yeah, we've had guests on Veterans Radio recently that talked about that's an area we really need to concentrate our attention on. Because it's pretty a dangerous area. I mean, so many parts of the world are dangerous right now, but this is something that could potentially cause us problems in the not too distant future.
Right.
In talking about not just the Marine Corps, so the Navy, this I found was really interesting. So we got the Navy with the first female top officer, ever. Admiral Lisa Franchetti, mm-hmm. and so she's in charge of the whole deal. That's cool.
Right. That's right. And she comes with some impressive bona fides. You know, she's been out in the fleet. She's commanded sailors underway at a very high level. And in general, she's just an impressive sailor to serve under. So as you mentioned or alluded to earlier, there was this lengthy hold on nominations of officers for promotion. She was part of that. So her ascending to the position of Chief of Naval Operations was somewhat delayed, but she's now in place and the Navy is leading the way.
They are leading the way, and they're well. You know, we mentioned earlier on that there are things going on in the Middle East, and around the Red Sea and the Suez Canal, and so forth. And there are two Navy carriers there right now. We got the Gerald R. Ford and the Dwight D. Eisenhower are there, and I'm sure that many of those retaliatory flights are taking off from those aircraft carriers.
Not only that, so that was a very, very fast response from the Navy. And on behalf of the whole Defense Department, the Navy was sort of the forward arm of that response following the October 7th attacks by Hamas on Israel to get out into the Med, to have a carrier presence, to say, we are here and we are responsive and we are at the ready. Since even that, sort of that story that I put together at the end of the year, we have seen the Navy be a very prominent actor in defense. So there are a number of Navy ships, destroyers and cruisers that have very, very successfully blocked, defended, and returned fire against Houthi rebels out of Yemen, who are as best we know, acting on behalf of Hamas in sending out missiles toward Navy assets. So the Navy has acquitted itself very, very excellently so far, has just demonstrated its ability to maintain dominance in this area and to respond as needed.
I think it's always, concerning, I guess you could say to me, as people, that prod us, they're prodding us and we've got the biggest stick, I guess you could say, out there. And, and from a political standpoint, I guess it comes down to, we have to be careful because we don't want to, have this whole thing erupt into World War III or anything along those lines. But we still can't allow, these small groups, that are being, supported by other other states to hold up the business of transferring goods, through the Suez Canal or through the Red Sea and so forth. And I think that all of these small little organizations that, I don't know about you, but I wouldn't want to take on an aircraft carrier or a destroyer or anything along those lines, because you have to know that they're going to retaliate, and they're going to retaliate 3 times, 30 times over what you can do.
That's right. The Navy always wants to maintain overmatch. And that goes for all of the services, but they're the power in the seas, no doubt.
Well, yeah. I mean, we go all the way back to the Roosevelt with the big stick thing. So we're moving, trying to move along. I don't want to lose you while we're talking. So I know. The other thing I wanted to ask you about was the Ghost Fleet.
The Ghost Fleet. Yes. So this is really wild. The Navy, not unlike the Air Force with its boneyard, has a number of ships that are always that are sort of in this in-between area where they're out of commission, but they're not in the scrap heap yet. And so proposals every once in a while come up to say, hey, can we reactivate some of these ships and add to our numbers? And the Navy for several years now has been very, very preoccupied with how many ships do we need in our overall fleet? And what is that number and how do we get to it? Because building ships in the shipyard is very cost intensive, but even more than that, very time intensive. And there are a limited number of shipyards to draw from. And so building more ships, adding to the fleet faster than the Navy can retire old ships, mm-hmm. has been just a really difficult problem for the Navy for a while. So that's where this kind of concept comes from.
I just thought that was interesting. Ghost fleet is like floating around out there some long, with the pirate ships and so forth that were out there. But it sounds like they're trying to upgrade these ships without building new ones.
Exactly. That's a proposal on the table. I'm not sure where it will go. Another thing to pay attention to is the Navy building unmanned ships. So they're cheaper, they tend to be smaller, but if you can predict their movements, make sure they're capable and you're controlling them, that's a way that the service is also pursuing to build out its fleet to the desired number.
That's kind of interesting. It's sort of like the pizza guys in our town with their robot delivery vehicles, trying to see how that works. All right. That's cool. I like that. All right. So we got the Navy and they're sort of increasing their special ops training. And one of the things in the article, as I mentioned before, we're talking with Hope Hodge-Sect. Her article is in the Military Officers Association of America's magazine, called The Military Officer Never Stops Serving. And she's kind of taken a look at each of the military services and what we can anticipate with the upcoming year. So we've gone through the Army, Marine Corps, and the Navy. Now let's go to the Air Force. And the Air Force is increasing their special op training, where they're holding training exercises with the Army's 160th Special Operations Aviation Unit. And those are the guys that take the SEAL Team 6 people around on their missions. And so it sounds like that the Air Force wants to get more involved in that.
Yeah, a very, very exciting concept. I always am interested personally when I see the services looking for opportunities to be what you might call joint. Mm-hmm. I think very often they get siloed. So they are reinventing the wheel or doing the same thing in kind of different colored iterations. But I also believe that this kind of combined effort is reflective of what they're anticipating for the future fight, which is opportunities for the services to lean on each other's capabilities and to draw on what's available. Again, as we were talking about with the Marine Corps, looking to operate in sort of austere areas where there's not a fancy base with a KFC inside. You know, you have things where the Air Force might be using Army assets or vice versa. Another piece of the overall Air Force vision puzzle is what they call agile combat employment. Again, they've been rolling this out over the last few years. And again, that's the ability for aircraft and squadrons sort of bunny hop to austere areas like the Pacific, use the available resources, whether they belong to the Army or the Navy or what have you, and deploy force in kind of like a hub and spoke way to reach further out with their power.
It sounds reasonable, and I would think it'd be very cost effective, as you know, if they're working together on some of these things. I know there's duplication as far as weaponry and so on and so forth, but if, you know, for instance, if the Marines don't have enough people somewhere, then the Army could add to it, or the Air Force could come in before the Navy has the opportunity to get their planes on station, types of things. I think that's really really kind of a really efficient. And the other thing that the Air Force is doing that you mentioned is that they have a new jet coming out. What is it? The sixth generation fighter is taking shape, replacing the F-22 Raptor. Can you tell us a little bit about what's coming out with that?
Yes. So this is the NGAD, the next generation air dominance. And this is the exciting new thing. Now, I feel like I say this a lot and have already said this, but these efforts are years in the making, and we sort of get little scraps and pictures of what these next capabilities might be. But we don't yet have a sixth generation fighter aircraft anywhere in the US military. There have been only two fifth generation fighters. There's the F-35, which the Air Force, the Navy, and the Marine Corps have, and there's the F-22, which was which is an Air Force program that was cut short in terms of production. So there is a limited number of F-22s. Now, when you talk about the capabilities for, you know, the kind of the next level Air Force fighters, it's a lot less of sort of like the dogfighting maneuvers that we think about with, you know, Tom Cruise and Top Gun and his F-14 Tomcat. And it's much more about being networked in the sky. So you have just an unprecedented view of the battlefield and everything in it, and everything is talking to each other, and you can sneak up on the enemy well before they're aware that you're in the area.
I think one of the things that kind of, you know, attaching to that is to talk a little bit about what the Space Force is up to with their, you know, I didn't want to leave them out. You know, is that they're focusing, it says, on positioning, navigation, time, and electromagnetic warfare. Ooh, big word.
Yes. The Space Force is fundamentally different than any other service out there. And they're leaning into that. You recall that they date back only to December of 2020. So they just passed their three-year birthday, and they don't have a lot of, well, you know, they're not deploying to space. They've got acquisition folks and satellite controllers. It's highly technical. And yet this is becoming an increasingly important part of warfare, is just maintaining dominance in space and in sort of the electromagnetic realm and everything that we can't see. So you're still seeing the Space Force looking for different ways to organize that makes sense for its specific needs and for its specific mission, which is unlike any of the other services.
Well, I think it's just, and based on what we were saying about, the Navy's trying to figure out where everything is, and then you got the Space Force is above them, and they could be working with all the different branches of the service and saying, okay, the bad guys are over here, and they have the ability to direct you toward wherever the action might be.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, finally, I need to get into the Coast Guard a little bit. This is my
Yes.
father's branch of the service. And it's not that they have a whole lot of things that are going on, but they do. This is the Coast Guard, and then this was something I didn't know before. The only service that can work in ice-locked waters, and they're getting a new icebreaker.
Yes, this is at long last. And not many people know this about the Coast Guard. And I'll shout out to my father-in-law, who is also a career coastie. But the Coast Guard is the only service that possesses this icebreaker capability. They've got two icebreakers, the Polar Star and the Healy. They're both incredibly old, should have retired a long time ago, and are more and more difficult to keep up and keep moving through the ice. And at the same time, these ice locked kind of Arctic northern waters are more important than they've ever been before, because you've got competition from Russia, you've got competition from China. There are folks in that space who haven't been as interested before, who are trying to claim it, for their power. So the Coast Guard, this I think they call it the Polar Security Cutter. They've been fighting for funding for it for a long time. It's moving forward in a really healthy way. I think the design is finalized, and they're getting the money that they need. So this is great news for the service, and it's been, I think if there's been anything that the Coast Guard has been asking for on Capitol Hill for the last few years, it's for this Polar Security Cutter to be what they need it to be.
I think just go. This is a great article, folks. I encourage you. I don't know where we could find it online. I suppose you could probably find it somewhere out there. I'd have to look for it. I mean, I'm a member of this organization, so that's how I got the magazine. But we have been talking with Hope Hodsek, and there's a couple of other services that unfortunately we don't have time to go into. And I would love to have you come back and talk a little bit more about the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and finally, the U.S. Public Service. I don't think people are aware of these branches of the service. But I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us here on Veterans Radio today, and keep writing these great articles, Hope. You're a it's great to have somebody that can explain these things to people like me and to many people in our audience. There's so many things that are going on.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you. We'll talk to you soon. All right. So that's Hope. And now we're going to go on to another story. But first, we're going to do our Medal of Honor. And when we come back from our Medal of Honor segment, we are going to be talking with Bill Graham, a Marine, of my generation of a Marine. And he's going to be talking about the case for universal national service. This is going to be kind of interesting, folks. So you're listening to Veterans Radio, and we will be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. First Lieutenant Jack Jacobs, although seriously wounded, made repeated trips across an open rice paddy, evacuating wounded and their weapons. Details after this.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
Jacob served as an assistant battalion advisor in Kien Phong Province, Republic of Vietnam. The battalion was advancing when it came under intense heavy machine gun and mortar fire. Jacobs called for and directed airstrikes on the enemy positions. Due to the intensity of the enemy fire and heavy casualties to the command group, including the company commander, the attack stopped and the friendly troops became disorganized. Wounded by mortar fragments, Jacobs assumed command of the company, ordered a withdrawal from the exposed position, and established a defensive perimeter. Despite heavy bleeding from head wounds that impaired his vision, Jacobs returned under intense fire to evacuate a seriously wounded advisor to safety, where he administered life-saving first aid. He then returned through heavy automatic weapons fire to evacuate the wounded company commander. Jacobs made repeated trips across the fire-swept open rice paddies, evacuating wounded and their weapons. On three separate occasions, Jacobs drove off Viet Cong squads who were searching for Allied wounded and weapons, single-handedly killing three and wounding several others. His actions saved the lives of a U.S. advisor and 13 Allied soldiers. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest among us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. If you know a veteran in crisis, don't wait, reach out. Call the Veterans Crisis Line at 988, then press 1. 988, press 1. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
And we're back here on Veterans Radio, and my guest coming up is Bill Graham, and Bill is a Marine, Vietnam-era Marine, and I'm anxious to talk to Bill about the idea of this case for universal national service. So, Bill, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you, Dale. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's good to have you on the program. Just for our audience's sake, I found Bill because I've actually I was trying to get caught up on reading all of these magazines that we get for these various organizations that some of us are in. And that's where I found my last guest, Hope. This one comes from the November and December issue of the VVA Veteran magazine. And in it, there is the article. It's called The Case for Universal National Service. And Bill, I guess you were asked to write an article about this.
Yeah, well, what I did was back in 2013, I wrote an article and never sent it anyplace. I just put my thoughts on paper after having seen, ironically, Colonel Jack Jacobs on CNN one day. And he was talking about mandatory service and that he did not think that the Selective Service, the Selective Service program we now have should be activated again, in that it had too much selectiveness as part of it. And I think that was borne out during the Vietnam era, that it became too selective.
Talking to many of our listeners and, you know, in our age group, we had a number of options. We could enlist.
Yeah.
That was number one. We could get drafted.
Right.
If we were still in college and some other ways we could defer our entry into the service. And worst case scenario is the guys went to Canada. I have a friend from high school. I think he still lives there. I don't think he ever came back, but the idea being is that the argument in your article is that it was a disproportionate number of people from lower incomes and so forth that were getting caught up in the draft because they didn't have the means to get deferred.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's, you know, so many people, they did multiple tours of duty in combat zones, and we didn't realize the effect all that had until years later when the post-traumatic stress became, you know, really at the forefront, and suicide rates began to really, really skyrocket. And that's when it really comes to the surface, and we have to examine it. And selective service, I don't think I agree with Colonel Jacobs. And I don't think it's the answer. And I think personally, I believe that the answer lies in service, and whether it be the Peace Corps, AmeriCorps, or the military service.
I agree. I mean, I can remember, you know, having discussions even when I was in the service,
sure,
about, you know, how do we become more inclusive? How do we get more people to understand that, you know, it's not just being in the military that's serving the country. We need other ways that we need to be aware of what this country provides for us. You know,
exactly.
Kind of like a, you know, John Kennedy type of thing.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it doesn't necessarily, not everybody's cut out to be in the military.
Right.
We know that too.
I agree with that.
But there are so many different options that are available. You know, as you mentioned, the Peace Corps, the AmeriCorps, you know, Teaching for America, Conservation Corps, and so forth. And I think what was in the article was implied is that everybody, and we're talking everybody, men and women that are physically able to participate, would donate 2 years of their lives to the country, either 2 years in the service or the other things that we mentioned there. And at the end of that 2 years, if you want to stay in, you can stay in. If you want to get out, there probably would be some sort of GI Bill available to them.
Yes. In fact, in reading the AmeriCorps and Peace Corps have a stipend at the end of that will help reintegrate yourself into whatever field you want to go. And there's a payment program while you're engaged in that, rightfully so. You're not become a millionaire by doing that, but you will be able to contribute to the country that we call the United States of America, that so many people want to come to, and we can reduce the divide between us and them, the civilian sector as opposed to the military sector, and the two can meet and become the country we want to be.
I agree with you, Bill. And I think it's, you know, we've got less than 1% of the population is in the military
right
today. And there are a lot of people out there who don't have any connection at all to the military any longer, unless it was their great grandfather.
Exactly. Yes.
And, you know, so we've got to figure out, I think we have to make, we need to figure out a way to make people appreciate what we have.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, politics aside, we won't go into that. But that we still, in my mind, you know, we're still the greatest country in the world, I think. Not that other countries aren't great and so forth in their own way. But, I mean, we're still this experiment. Which, you know, I mean, we're the young kids on the block. I mean, what are we, 230 some years old? And, you know, that we're offering everybody the opportunity, and I think that's the magic word there, is that opportunity to benefit from living here.
Yes.
And I think everybody should add a little bit to that if they are going to live here.
Right. Yeah. And we also have to, as relates to the military, get through to others that just because you join the military doesn't mean you're going off and shooting people. And that is such a misnomer. And talking with, you know, young folks and those folks who have never joined, well, I don't want my kid to go off and just be deployed and start shooting this and getting shot himself. There are so many opportunities in the military, it's mind-boggling, actually. And if we could get beyond those misnomers, I think we would be, you know, be able to fill the ranks in which they're having difficulty doing now, and at the same time fulfilling some of the social responsibilities that could be done by not being in the military through the 2-year commitment.
Well, you know, the guest I had on earlier before we came on the air, I was talking with Hope, and she was talking about all the technology that's involved in all the branches.
Yes.
Of service. You know, it's not everybody just runs around, as you mentioned, you know, carrying a rifle.
Right.
There are computer experts that are in the field. I mean, these guys, and you've talked to them as well, you know, they take computers with them out into the field.
Right.
For communications, for targeting, for updates on weather and everything else that is out there. And that's not the only thing. I mean, they design the weaponry, they deploy the weaponry. You've got all these ships. You know, and I wasn't in the Navy, but I know that there's a lot going on in a ship that, other than jets taking off from aircraft carriers.
That's right. Yeah, that's so. And even in the Marine Corps, and the Marine Corps, you know, has the reputation of, well, you can come from jail and grab a rifle and go to the Marine Corps. Well, that's not true. And I can tell you my own story. I started out as a rifleman after recruit training until it was discovered I knew how to type. And it went on from there.
Uh-oh.
And that was 1960. And I spent my life, my career in the personnel administration and doing things.
You know, and that goes back to the thing about, you know, what is it that you need 9 to 10 administrative people or support troops for every one person in the field.
Sure.
And again, not every one of those people, you know, is going to run around carrying a rifle or a pistol.
That's-
And the, you know, whatever that is, but you have to have those support people to do that. And the idea then is coming out when you come out of the service, you have skills that you didn't even know you had.
That's right.
That are not related just to, you know, firing guns and rifles and so forth.
Yeah. And you have a better appreciation for other cultures at the same time because mm-hmm. you've been around other cultures. If you never leave your city block, that becomes your world, and expand your horizons beyond that, and you begin to appreciate other things and other people. But it has so many pluses to it, and fewer minuses.
Well, I think so. You know, when you look back at the all volunteer force that came about in 1973 as a result of the ineffective draft system that was going on at the time, you know, yes, it was great. Okay, everybody's a volunteer, but not everybody was in the game, and not everybody has, you know, forget the terminology. You know, you don't have any money in the game,
right?
And so, you know, we're all supportive of the troops that are overseas and, you know, blah, blah, blah. We, you know, food packages and so forth. But I think it's so much more important, whether it's the military or the Peace Corps or any of these opportunities that these young people would have to just serve their country for this 2-year time period. And, you know, I'm sure that, you know, the negotiations and compromises would allow them, you know, not necessarily, you know, it's requiring everybody between the ages of 18 and 25. So if you wanted to go to college, you could get college out of the way and then put your 2 years in.
Yes. And if you were, I would say, and it would be a proposal I would make, if you're already, registered for college, go to college, and you would put that 2 years on hold until such time as you finished college, then spend your 2 years and go about your life. And you could reflect back upon the World War II, folks who came back and had put their lives on hold for however long, and carried on. Some became leaders of the country, others leaders in the military, and went on with corporations. So it's not the end of things by spending 2 years of your life dedicated to service to the country.
No, and I think one of the things that we're talking about here with Bill Graham and the case for universal national service is that if everybody does it,
yes,
or if everybody participates in it, then there's no sense of loss by those who do it. And I mean, this is just a personal story. I mean, I can remember, you know, I spent, who counted, right? 3 years, 7 months, and 2 days in the service. But when I came home, the guys I had hung around beforehand who had gotten the deferments were now 4 years ahead of me career-wise.
Sure.
And that's something that I think that this idea is attempting to address. And I just think, I don't know, is there anybody else talking about this other than, you know, a couple of years ago when the late Charlie Rangel of New York, he introduced that in 2011. I guess it didn't go anywhere.
No, it didn't go anywhere. And in 2013, there was a house record 748, 113th Universal National Service Act that was, it was introduced, and that was it. It died right there. So, you know, it doesn't have a lot of traction, if you will.
How do we go about getting some traction? Do you have any? Have you been able to talk to any politicians who might be willing to support this?
I have not. No, the idea came up in the Vietnam Veterans magazine, and I said, well, I have some insight on this that I'd researched previously, so I sent that off. That's what prompted this interaction today. Mm-hmm. I would certainly not frown at going forth with a proposal to a congressional member.
I think it'd be interesting to see if we could find a congressional member that would support this thing. You know, they have to be out there. I mean, there are still a couple of veterans that are serving in Congress.
Yes.
And
there are, there seems to be more now from Afghanistan and Iraq era in the legislature now. So perhaps there is.
Yeah, you would think that they would be very interested in something like this, especially those men and women that did the 5 and 6 tours.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
oh my God. I can't imagine. I cannot imagine doing more than one tour.
yeah,
but, you know, 5 or 6. I mean, obviously, that's going to add to the amount of post-traumatic stress out there. It's going to add to the numbers of those 22 a day suicides that are still going on.
That's
so we
right.
have to figure out a way to fix this, Bill. And anything that I can do to help you, I'd be more than glad to get on the train with you and see if we can get this at least out of the station.
Right. And I'll certainly keep you up to date on any progress I make.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. So we've been talking with Bill Graham, Marine from the Vietnam era, and his article in the VVA, the Veteran, was called The Case for Universal National Service. And I encourage everybody to get an opportunity either to read that article or go to our website, veteransradio.org. And we've got some information on how to get at these articles that we've been talking about today. And let's see what we can do. You know, what's your opinion? What do you think? So shoot me an email and let me know. We can have set up a group discussion on our program one day and talk about should Universal National Service be something that we should be exploring. So again, Bill Graham, thank you very much for being on the program.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. I love reading these. There are great stories in all these magazines to all of our listeners.
Okay.
So, you know, we encourage you to do that. Next week, Jim Falzone will be here, and he's going to be talking with a couple of veterans for Black History Month. And we're going to be some other things like that along the lines. So this is Dale Thronberry for all of us here at Veterans Radio. Until next week, you are dismissed.
Oh, beautiful, for spacious skies, for amber waves of green, for purple mountain majesties, above the fruited plains.
America, America, God shed his grace on thee and crowned the good with brotherhood from sin to shine. From sea